Only after she had put on the shoes did she realize that this outfit was what she wore in the firewalking dream, which she'd had the previous night again for the fifth night in a row. In addition to feeling almost pretty, she now channeled at least a measure of the sense of invulnerability that made the dream so delightful. Although Dixie Belle usually lay on the bed to watch her mistress dress, on this occasion she was under the bed, only her head and long ears poking out from beneath the quilted spread. Cora said, "You're a funny dog, Miss Dixie. Sometimes you can be so silly." Chapter 12. At 9 o'clock, there began to be a minor risk of a realtor escorting clients on a tour of the empty house. But on a weekday like this, most working buyers would schedule an appointment after 5 o'clock. Anyway, if an agent showed up with clients, Jane wouldn't need to pull a gun on them. There was an attic access in the ceiling of the walk-in closet next to the master bedroom, a segmented ladder which she pulled down now in preparation, just in case. At the first sound of voices downstairs, she would retreat to the upper realm of spiders and silverfish and pull the folding ladder up behind her. In the bedroom, once more, she took a compact FM receiver from the tote bag and plugged it into an outlet under the window from which she had earlier conducted surveillance of the Hennepin place. This special receiver, which incorporated an amplifier and recorder, operated below the commercial band where radio stations plied their trade, and it was pre-tuned to an unused spot on the dial that matched the carrier wave issued by the transmitters that she had secreted in Hannafin's 4 phones. She would need this receiver only if the journalist used one of the landline phones to call someone. If he needed to talk to anyone before she spoke to him at noon, he would most likely resort to his smartphone. Most people thought that cell phone calls were far more difficult to tap. In fact, they were difficult, though not in all circumstances, and not when the person conducting the surveillance made the proper preparations. From the tote, Jane extracted a disposable cell phone, one of 3 that she currently owned, each of which she had purchased weeks earlier at different big-box stores. A programmed electronic whistle, approximately the size of a rifle cartridge and capable of reproducing any sound code, was taped beside the cell's microphone. After parting the draperies 6 inches, giving her a view of the Hannafin residence, she entered the journalist's landline number in her disposable cell. She pressed send, and an instant later triggered the electronic whistle. The chip she had wired into Hannafin's 4 phones offered 2 functions. First, as a standard line tap to listen in to calls. Second, as an infinity transmitter. The sound code produced by the electronic whistle triggered the infinity transmitter, which stopped the journalist's phones from ringing. Simultaneously, it turned on their microphones and broadcast sounds in the house over the phone line to Jane. The phones in Hannafin's kitchen, living room, and study had nothing but silence to transmit, which meant she could hear clearly what was happening in the master bedroom. The tap, tap, tap of hammer against screwdriver handle and the thin shriek of a pivot pin being driven out of the barrel of a hinge confirmed that he had found the tools that she had hidden among his clothes. Not long after the hammering had stopped and the pins had been removed from the 3 hinges, she heard the door rattling in its frame as he struggled with it. A sudden quiet, followed by muffled cursing, meant he realized a hard truth. Although the knuckles that formed the barrel hinges, 3 on the door leaf, 2 on the frame leaf, would part now that the pins no longer held them together, the door would not open more than 1 inch because it remained secured by the blind deadbolt. That was why she had provided him with a sturdy screwdriver and a 20-ounce steel claw hammer rather than lighter tools. To open the solid core door, he would now need to split and gouge the wood, either to pry loose the door-mounted hinge leaves or to dig his way even deeper to expose the guts of the blind deadbolt, which would be an exhausting job. She had told him he would be able to free himself in 15 or 20 minutes, but that had been a lie. He would need perhaps an hour to break out of the closet. She wanted him to have plenty of time to think about her proposal before he could get to a phone, and she hoped that, in his exhaustion, he would realize that in every moment of their brief relationship, she had been several steps ahead of him, and always would be. Chapter 13. 5 years earlier, Cora had completed a training course with Dixie Bell that qualified the dachshund as a therapy dog. Since then, she'd taken her best friend to school every day. Her students were all special needs kids, suffering developmental disabilities and a wide range of emotional problems. With her well-feathered tail and soulful eyes and vibrant personality, Miss Dixie did heroic duty in the classroom, letting herself be petted and hugged and teased, while invariably calming the children, assuaging the fears that afflicted them, and thereby helping them to focus. Indeed, Cora took Dixie with her everywhere. In the small laundry room off the kitchen, the dog stood under the perf board from which hung a few collars and leashes. She wagged her tail and looked up expectantly at her mistress. If she cared little for the outdoors, Dixie loved the classroom and going for rides in the Ford Expedition. Cora took down a red collar and a matching leash. She knelt to dress the dachshund and found her hands shaking too violently to match the halves of the collar clasp and click them together. She was meant to bring the dog. She understood that she was meant to bring precious Dixie. Understood that having the dog with her was for some reason a crowning detail, part of the portrait of herself that she was meant to paint on this eventful day. But her hands would not obey her. The collar clasp defeated her. The dog whined and backed through the open door into the kitchen, where she halted and watched and did not wag her tail. "I don't know," Cora heard herself say. "I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I should do." The still small voice, which she had thought of as being the expression of her intuition and her conscience, had not heretofore been audible. Rather, it had been more like a text message, words of light forming compelling sentences across a virtual screen in some dark office of her mind. But now, the message translated from light into sound, and a seductive male voice whispered inside her skull, "No time to delay. Move, move, move. Do what you were born to do. Fame escaped you as a writer, but fame will be yours when you do this that you were born to do. You will be famous and adored." She could resist the urge to take the dog, but she could not resist this voice. In fact, she was overcome by a desire to obey her conscience, her intuition, whatever it was. God, that spoke to her and stirred her heart with a promise of the fulfillment that had been so long denied her. When she returned the leash and collar to the perf board, her hands at once stopped shaking. To Dixie, she said, "Mommy won't be gone long, sweetheart. You be good. Mommy will be back soon." She opened the door between the laundry room and the garage, and a cold draft washed over her. She had forgotten her coat. She hesitated, but she must not delay. She needed to move, move, move. "I love you, Dixie. I love you so much," Cora said. And the dog whimpered. And Cora closed the door as she stepped into the garage. She didn't bother to switch on the fluorescent panels, but went directly to the driver's door of the snow-white Ford Expedition that stood softly glowing in the shadows of the only stall. She got behind the wheel and started the engine and used a remote to put up the big overhead door. Wintry daylight flooded into the garage as the segmented door clattered upward on its tracks, and it seemed to her that this was akin to the scintillant influx of light in movies that always announced a wondrous arrival, whether a fairy godmother or a benign extraterrestrial or some heaven-sent messenger. In her quiet, mundane life, momentous events were impending, and she was thrilled to the expectation of some not quite defined moment of glory. The faintest smell of gasoline induced Cora Gunderson to turn and peer into the back of the expedition. The rear seat had been put down. In the expanded cargo space, 15 bright red 2-gallon cans were lined up in 3 rows. The previous evening, she had unscrewed the top cap and the spout cap from each full can and had replaced them with double-thick swatches of plastic wrap secured with rubber bands. She forgot she had made these preparations. She remembered now, and she was not shocked. She surveyed the cans and knew that she should be proud of what she had done here, for the seductive voice praised her and spoke of what she had been born to do. On the front passenger seat stood a large metal stockpot in which she had cooked many soups and stews over the years. In the bottom of the pot were green bricks of the wet foam that florists used as the foundation of their arrangements, which she had bought at a garden store. Standing upright in the foam were 2 bundles of long-stemmed wooden matches, 10 per bundle, each group held together by 2 rubber bands, one under the match heads and the other toward the bottom of the thick stems. Beside the stockpot lay a small butane lighter. She thought the matches looked like 3 bunches of tiny withered flowers, magical flowers that, when a bewitching word was spoken, would bloom into bright bouquets. Scattered among the gasoline cans behind her were 200 match heads that she had scissored from their sticks. When she drove out into the gray day, she did not bother to pick up the remote and put down the garage door behind her. The lovely voice said that time was of the essence, and Cora was eager to see why that might be so. By the time she reached the end of the driveway, the heat issuing from the vents took the chill off her bare skin, and she had no need of a coat. At the end of the driveway, she turned right onto the 2-lane blacktop county road and drove toward town. Chapter 14. As she waited in the vacant house across the street, listening on her disposable phone, Jane found it interesting that during the 47 minutes Lawrence Hannafin required to break out of the closet, he never shouted for help. Placed near the center of the house, the closet lacked windows, and maybe the journalist knew the residence was so well constructed that no one beyond its walls would hear him calling out. Or maybe he had already decided that the story she'd offered him was too big to turn down, regardless of the risks, in which case he would not want to summon help and explain who had locked him away. She dared to hope. With a final crash, the distant closet door flew open, or more likely collapsed onto the bedroom floor, followed by Hannafin's labored breathing, which swelled louder as he crossed the room, approaching the phone on his nightstand, but then grew softer as he evidently stepped into the master bathroom, leaving the door open behind him. A new sound arose, and she needed a moment to decide that it must be water running in the bathroom sink. He would be thirsty after his exertions, and he might wish as well to splash cold water on his sweaty face. After a minute, he turned off the water, and there was only a faint series of unidentifiable noises until a clank was followed by the unmistakable sound of him taking a piss. The clank had probably been the toilet seat knocking against the tank. Evidently, he didn't bother to wash his hands. He returned from the bathroom. Judging by the nearness of his agitated breathing and the soft twang of box springs, he sat on the edge of the bed, within arm's reach of the telephone and its open mic. If he picked up the handset to make a call, she would have to disconnect at once, shutting down the Infinity transmitter by which she was listening to him, so that he would receive a dial tone. At that point, the two-purpose chip that she had planted in his phone would switch to a simple line-tap transmission, and the conversation he held with whomever he called would come to her by way of the combination FM receiver, amplifier, and recorder that stood on the windowsill. As though trying to calm himself, he took a series of slow, deep breaths. Apparently that didn't work, because he could not contain his fury when from him erupted a colorful volley of obscenities. And then he must have switched on his smartphone, because across the open line came the signature welcoming music of his telecom provider. He evidently believed that a wireless call would be private and far less vulnerable than one made on a traditional landline. She'd hoped that he wouldn't reach out to anyone, that he would wait for her to ring him up at noon, as she had said she would. He might be placing an innocent call, perhaps to cancel an appointment he no longer wished to keep, something like that, but the odds were she was going to be disappointed in him. No ketones sounded to suggest that he entered a telephone number to place a call. Instead, he muttered bitterly to himself,
"Crazy syphilitic bitch. Yeah, I have a pair, you twat, and they aren't just decoration."
She suspected that she knew about whom he was speaking. Another sound might have been a drawer opening.
"Try me again, bitch. I'll put one right between your tits."
Maybe he had removed the revolver from the nightstand drawer. For about a minute, he undertook some task that she could not identify, for there were only soft rustling sounds. Then came a series of key tones as he made a call. Evidently, he had put his cell on speakerphone, because a woman answered after the second ring. "Woodbine, Kravitz, Larkin, and Benedetto."
"A law firm."
Hannafin said, "Randall Larkin, please."
"One moment, please."
Another woman's voice.
"Randall Larkin's office."
"Lawrence Hannafin for Randy."
"He's on another call, Mr. Hannafin."
"I'll hold."
"He may be a while."
"Use your whisper line. Let him know it's urgent. It's a matter of life and death."
Standing at the window of the vacant house, burner phone to her ear, waiting for Randall Larkin to take the journalist's call, Jane Hawk watched the storm front, dark as iron, as it conquered the sky and pressed a menacing, shadowed stillness from Glendora to Pasadena and points in between. Chapter 15. Cora Gunderson lived in a rural area of broad rolling fields and conifer forests, Coster pines, cerulea, jack pines, Norway spruce, the meadows now blanketed with pristine snow and the trees garlanded like those on Christmas cards. The county road had been well cleared, unspooling as black as tuxedo satin through the bridal white land. White seemed to be the theme of the day, the landscape through which she passed, the vehicle she drove, the dress she wore, the fog that obscured her memory and veiled her intentions from her. That mental cloud did not trouble her. In fact, comforted her now that her dog was safe at home and she was warm while gliding through a winter wonderland. Freedom from too much thinking was a blessing. All her life, her mind had raced as she had written reams of fiction she'd never dared submit to an agent or publisher, as she had devised new classroom techniques to reach the special needs children who had been entrusted to her, as she had lobbied the school board to better serve girls and boys that too many people were quick to dismiss as inconvenient, a drag on society. Now she thought only of the beauty and peacefulness of the land through which she passed, of the inner voice that cared about her and promised her fulfillment. The drive into town would take half an hour if she did not speed, and she must not speed. She had never received a ticket for speeding or for any other violation. She took quiet pride in a life lived by the corpus juris of her country during a time when the rule of law seemed everywhere under assault and corruption rampant. For a reason she did not understand, or need to understand, she knew that on this day of all days, she must drive with respect for the rules of the road and not be stopped by a patrolman. 25 minutes into her journey, the storm imprisoned in the frozen heavens suddenly broke free. From a sky invisible, a dazzling quantity of snow shimmered down. In the SUV, with windows all around, Cora seemed to float through this spectacle as if the mechanics of a snow globe had been reversed, so that around her lay a worldwide winter, while she marveled at it from within a snowless sphere of glass. The lovely inner voice encouraged her to view this snowfall as an omen. The storm could not frost her curly hair or chill her, just as the fire in her dream could not harm her. Here was an omen that confirmed the invulnerability that had been conferred upon her. Absolute protection from all things hot and cold, from all things sharp and blunt, from all mortal forces. She passed through the outskirts of town. She pulled to the curb at the head of Fitzgerald Avenue, a long and easy slope that formed a T-intersection with Main Street. She picked up the butane lighter and tested it to be sure that it worked. If, for any reason, it failed her, there was another lighter in the glove box. It did not fail her. Chapter 16. The sky darkening and ulcerous, the Hannafin residence and its craftsman detail now became like some cursed house in a fairy tale. The window of this vacant home glazed with the faintest phantom reflection of Jane with the cell phone to her ear. Randall Larkin of Woodbine Kravitz Larkin and Benedetto took the call from Lawrence Hannafin.
A matter of life and death? It had better be no less than that, Larry, considering that I had to put off a major client who isn't used to being put off.
Your line's secure, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we sweep it twice a day. Are you on speakerphone?
Don't sweat it. I'm alone, getting dressed.
Some shit's hit the fan. Damn if she's catching me naked again. She who?
I just had a visitor. The widow. The 5-star bitch last seen in Napa.
Jane thought that Larkin's failure to respond might mean that he could not at once interpret the journalist's description. But in fact, his was a stunned silence. Then, anger and incredulity twined in his voice.
Holy shit! You're yanking my chain! She just rang your damn doorbell?
I come out of the shower. There she is with a gun in my face.
But she can't know.
She can't, Hannafin agreed. She doesn't.
How the hell can she know about you?
She doesn't, Hannafin repeated. She wants to trust me. Wants me to break the story. She laid it all out.
Where is she now?
I don't know. She told me to think about it. Said she'll call after I think about it. Then she locked me in a closet so I couldn't follow her, see what she was driving. I had to bust my way out. The bitch left me with a hammer and screwdriver. I'd like to get her down naked and show her another use for the damn screwdriver.
Don't go off about this.
I'm not going off.
You sound like you're going off.
I said I'm not. It's an opportunity.
It's an incredible opportunity,
Larkin agreed.
I don't think she's a brunette anymore. She was wearing a long blonde wig, which made her look the way she originally did before all this started. She'd only be wearing that if she didn't want me to see how she's changed the color and style of her hair so it doesn't match either of the photos on the NCIC website.
What do I give a shit about her hair?
Larkin asked. I'm a reporter. I notice details. I'm just saying. Anyway, she's going to call me at noon.
Can we locate her then?
She'll use a burner phone, but maybe there's a way. Tell our disc jockey she's tied him to this. She believes I think he's a phony.
Jane figured disc jockey was a way of saying DJ, which were the first two initials of David James Michael, the charming billionaire with three first names. Perhaps the trace of acid in Hannafin's profile of Michael had been calculated so that it would not appear as if he lived in the rich man's pocket.
First, Larkin said, I have to get our NSA guy moving fast.
Noon doesn't give us much time. I don't know if it's possible.
Suppose we put her away, the journalist said.
Then I should be bumped up to editor sooner. All things in their time.
Screw that. I want some gratitude.
I don't have time for this now.
I want some gratitude, Randy.
Only a year, and you forget what's already been done for you?
A promise is a promise, and I've been promised this.
I'm sure you'll get the big desk. Now sit tight.
Count on it,
Hannafin said, and he terminated the call. Over the journalist's open landline came the clack of his smartphone being put down on the nightstand. Jane could hear him moving around. He must have finished getting dressed. They were going to make him the editor of what? The newspaper for which he wrote? If David James Michael owned any part of that publication or its parent company, his interest was deeply hidden. So Hannafin proved to be a little piggy with his nose in DJ Michael's trough. One more sellout in a world of sellouts. She had not put much hope in him, but when it came to newsmen, he was the only hope she currently had. If depression had been a viable option, she might have bought a bottle of vodka and checked into a motel under a false name and gone AWOL from this war for a few days. But her beautiful child, Travis, lived under threat of death, and her husband's memory was stained by murder disguised as suicide. And her father, the celebrated pianist, remained out there on a successful concert tour, hoping that his long-estranged daughter, now a notorious fugitive, would be either imprisoned or shot dead before she could make him pay for what he had done to her mother 19 years earlier. She had no time for depression. Not a minute. Neither did she have the slightest inclination toward depression. Depression was for those despairing people who decided that life had no meaning. But Jane knew that, instead, life had too much meaning to process, that every minute of life was rich with meaning, crammed full to the top with meaning. Some of its meaning was as clear and poignant as a needle in the neck, some of such a joyful nature that your buoyant heart seemed capable of lifting you high among the birds, although much of life's most profound meaning lay beyond her understanding, latent and mysterious. Standing at the window, watching the craftsman-style house across the street, she wondered how she could best bring some meaning into the life of Lawrence Hannafin, so that the journalist might benefit from her gift, might see with clear eyes the wretched meaning of his life as he had thus far lived it, and might hope to improve himself when at last he recognized his current position in this numinous universe as worse than that of a cockroach scuttling blindly through a lightless sewer. Chapter 17. The hidden sky, shedding flakes like flower heads, petaling the day as though with a million weddings' worth of carnations, Cora Gunderson, dressed all in white, while a pleasant whiteness cosseted her mind, the bleached white wood of long-stemmed matches bundled efficiently. The flame from the butane lighter ignited the first cluster of blue match heads, which made a sputtering whooshing sound as they flared into a miniature torch. She dropped the lighter and piloted the expedition away from the curb, onto Fitzgerald Avenue once more, heading downhill toward the intersection with Main Street. At the end of Fitzgerald, directly across Main, stood the historic Veblen Hotel, built in 1886 and renovated 3 times since then, most recently the previous year. The restaurant claimed half the hotel's ground floor street frontage and provided large windows that, at this moment, captured an enchanting view of the quaint downtown district bespangled with falling snow. As she approached the intersection that lay 1 long block uphill from Main Street, Cora held the steering wheel with her left hand and with her right hand plucked the bunch of long-stemmed bright-burning matches from the wet florist foam. She used it to light the second bunch, And then she tossed the first little torch into the back of the expedition, where at once it ignited some of the 200 match heads scattered among the gasoline cans. The sulfur smell spreading through the vehicle had not been part of her firewalking dream, but Cora didn't find it offensive. She thought of it as the scent of invulnerability. The still, small voice told her to breathe deeply, to inoculate herself against all risk of burning, to be again the figure of wonder that inspired awe in onlookers. In the cargo space behind her, the carpet almost at once caught fire. The thin smoke was less appealing than the sulfurous fragrance of burning matches, but of course it could do her no harm. On the drive to town, the gasoline in the 15 cans had been affected by the motion of the SUV, sloshing and swirling against the confining metal walls, generating heat that caused a minor expansion in volume, raising from it fumes to swell the plastic wrap that served as caps on the filler holes and spouts. Those gossamer swatches of plastic film inflated like miniature balloons, and some partly detached from the rubber bands that fixed them in place. Volatile vapors condensed on the inner surface of those inadequate prophylactics, dribbled out through tiny breaches, and slithered down the cans, not in quantity, but in the thinnest streams, perhaps no more than an ounce or two from all the containers combined. By the time Cora entered the final block of Fitzgerald and began to accelerate toward Maine, toward the historic Veblen Hotel, the hungry flames crawled up the cans and found the plastic wrap and devoured it. As she threw the second bundle of burning matches into the space behind her, she heard the whoomp of one of those reservoirs of gasoline taking the fire unto itself, and then another whoomp. But because the cans were vented in two places, and because the rapidly rising temperature was not quite yet sufficient to precipitate a catastrophic expansion of the fuel, no immediate explosion ensued. Only the noisy rush of flames from spout and filler hole. The rearview mirror presented a reflection of flames churning in kaleidoscopic splendor. And Cora saw pedestrians on the sidewalk stop and point and stare, stunned that she had progressed from firewalking to fire driving. Their astonishment delighted her, and she laughed, not in the least alarmed by the suddenly torrid air, for she was now as she had always been, fireproof. She was both the writer and the protagonist of this amazing story, and although the air was abruptly so dry and hot that it instantly chapped her lips and cracked the lining of her nostrils, she feared not, for the lovely inner voice that encouraged her must be the voice of the god who had counseled and protected Shadrach in the furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego survived the capital punishment of the king's furnace without one singed hair, and so would she escape this test unscorched, while onlookers marveled and called out in admiration. As the flames lapped the back of the driver's seat and purled across the console between the front seats, as smoke seethed forward, Cora Gunderson knew one terrible moment in this otherwise triumphant procession. She glimpsed a dog, on a leash, standing with its master on the sidewalk. Although it was a golden retriever rather than a long-haired dachshund, she remembered Dixie Belle at home alone, and she was pierced by an intense longing for her sweet Dixie, a longing that for a moment cleared her mind, so that she realized the horror of her situation. But with whispered reassurance, the small voice within flushed terror away with a rush of joy, and she cried out in ecstasy as flames quivered from the console onto the hem of her skirt. When the heat blew out the window of the tailgate door, much of the smoke was sucked out through that breach, flames on the console feathering backward and brushing bright wings across Cora's curly hair. She tramped the accelerator to the floor. With the vivacity of an indomitable heroine in this best tale that she had ever written, she issued a cry of victory as she rocketed toward the intersection. Under a hard sky, whiter than a cataracted eye, through snow cascading like a crystallized Niagara, the white expedition cleaved the torrents, and she, in white as in the dream, wearing the only dress in which she had ever felt somewhat pretty, drove through the front wall of the hotel restaurant, great sheets of glass crashing down on the attendees of the luncheon, tables and chairs and dishes and people flung aside by her grand entrance. At last, here were the explosions, releasing Cora Gunderson from this world. As the vehicle rocked to a halt, gouts of blazing gasoline vomiting through the spacious room, a threat that even the 6-man security team was inadequate to address, that engulfed them and the governor, who had come to town from the capital to celebrate the reopening of this historic hotel. Chapter 18. Jane kept the disposable cell phone near at hand. The Infinity transmitters and Lawrence Hannafin's landline phones still provided her with anything that he might say while he was in the 4 rooms of his residence in which they were located. In the master bathroom of the vacant house, she pulled off the blonde wig, put it in a plastic bag, and returned it to her big tote. Hannafin had been right when he suspected that she was neither blonde nor brunette anymore, nor was her auburn hair straight and shaggy, but just curly enough to fool the eye into reading her face in such a way that it seemed to have a different shape from the face in the most wanted photos on the internet. In her forsaken life, before she had gone on the run, she had rarely worn much makeup, hadn't needed it, but there were times now when base and cover and eyeshadow and lipstick could be a kind of mask that allowed her a sense of anonymity, perhaps greater than what they actually provided. Now she decided to remain makeup-free. She kept the baseball cap and took from the tote a pair of horn-rimmed eyeglasses with plain glass lenses, a stage prop for use when she left this place. At the bedroom window once more, waiting to hear what Randall Larkin would reveal when he called Hannafin, she reviewed in memory the previous conversation between those men. 2 things the attorney had said were of the most interest to her. I have to get our NSA guy moving fast. Noon doesn't give us much time. NSA must be the National Security Agency. The late Berthold Schenick's nanomachine brain implants had been the holy grail to such a wide array of power-drunk bastards that he and David James Michael were able to weave together a conspiracy involving private sector players and government officials who together corrupted key figures in the FBI, Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the National Security Agency. For starters, common sense suggested that the CIA, the IRS, and perhaps every department of the government, all the way to the heights of the executive branch and the legislature, must be, if not riddled with, at least infiltrated by members of this maniacal confederacy of utopian totalitarians. Of all the departments and agencies of the federal government concerned with law enforcement and national defense, the NSA was arguably the most secretive and powerful. Its million-square-foot Utah data center could winnow from the air every telephone call and text message and other digital transmission, store them, and conduct metadata analysis for evidence of terrorist activities and other threats to national security. The NSA didn't read the text messages or listen to the phone calls in real time, and even later reviewed only that tiny fraction of a percent flagged by an analytic scanning program. If Larkin and his ilk had a confederate at the NSA in a high enough position to assist in an effort to identify Jane's burner phone signal and her location while she was having a conversation with Lawrence Hannafin at noon, it could only mean that the rumored Metropolitan Overflight program was real. Even 4 years earlier, someone at the Bureau had speculated that in major cities, the NSA maintained special surveillance aircraft staffed and ready to be airborne within a few minutes of receiving a go order. When flying at modest altitudes that nevertheless allowed a monitoring radius of at least 50 miles, these planes were supposedly equipped to fish from the great river of telecom signals only those carrier waves reserved for cell phones. Further, The operator on board was said to be able to customize the analytic scanning program to search for words specific to a pending crisis, such as the names of those terrorists for whom they were searching, or the name of the target against which it was thought a terror cell might be planning an imminent attack. In this case, because the airborne search team would have Hannafin's smartphone and landline numbers, they could monitor those, wait for Jane's incoming call, and employ track-to-source technology to pinpoint her burner phone's location, whether she was sitting on a park bench or cruising in a car. That didn't matter. She knew now that Lawrence Hannafin wasn't an honest journalist. She wouldn't be calling him at noon. Because of Hannafin, however, she'd learned that the attorney, Larkin, was an associate of David James Michaels, maybe even one of the billionaire's inner circle. He was a fresh lead, a source. If she couldn't find a reporter to break the story, she would have to go after DJ Michael. A man of his wealth would be hard to corner. He would have the best security. If the founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, surrounded himself with 16 heavily armed bodyguards at all times, as had been reliably reported, then DJ Michael would most likely have more. Their fortunes were approximately equal, but Michael had more to hide. And he knew that she had already gotten to Berthold Schenek and an attorney, William Overton, who were close associates of his. They were dead. And though virtually every law enforcement agency in the country was looking for her, she so far remained free to stalk her quarry. The second thing of interest that Randall Larkin said during his phone conversation with Hannafin required interpretation, but she felt sure that she had arrived at the meaning of it. When the journalist pressed to be promoted to editor of his newspaper, when he declared that he deserved gratitude for giving them this shot at Jane, Larkin had responded obliquely. "Only a year, and you forget what's already been done for you?" Lawrence Hannafin's wife of 17 years, Sakura, had died a year earlier. Although Jane didn't know all the details, the woman had suffered a medical crisis of some kind. Hannafin hadn't been anywhere near his wife when it happened. He had been out of town on a story assignment. With friends like Randall Larkin and DJ Michael, he wouldn't have needed to risk getting blood on his hands. Chapter 19. For a couple minutes, the Infinity transmitters sent nothing but silence from Hannafin's house to Jane's disposable cell phone. When he began making noise again, she heard the clatter of dishes and the clink of flatware, the rattle of what might have been a frying pan dropped onto a gas burner, and she assumed that he had gone to the kitchen for breakfast. The coffee maker, which stood near the wall phone, began to percolate, the distinctive burbling sound confirming his location. In the street, traffic had declined. Children had gone off to school, parents off to work. Los Angeles and environs seldom saw a sky as malignant as this one, the enfolded clouds condensing gray into veins of black. In Virginia, where she had lived with Nick and where Travis had been born, storms usually came with dramatic skies, but here even foul weather was laid back, lightning and thunder rare. Maybe 5 minutes after the journalist entered the kitchen and 20 minutes after Larkin terminated their previous conversation, the attorney called back. Hannafin's smartphone ringtone was a few bars of Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. He took the call.
"Yeah. They're in the air," said Randall Larkin. "She calls early, they'll be sweeping frequencies and ready for her." "What about when you locate her?" "We figure she'll stay in the general area until she talks to you. In another 20 minutes, we'll have 6 ground units parked within a 20-mile radius of you, waiting." "What about the weather?" "Are you on speakerphone again? Makes me nervous. Don't get your panties in a wad. I need my hands. I'm making breakfast here. Plus, I've got a piece on the counter just in case."
"Piece? A piece of what?"
"A piece. A rod. A gun."
she figures to surprise me again, I'll put one between her tits. She'll call, like she said. She won't risk coming back until she's convinced you'll really help her.
You don't know what the hell this one will do. She's no more predictable than an earthquake. Anyway, what about the weather?
What about it? Larkin asked. If the storm breaks, the flyboys won't be grounded?
No. Only if maybe the wind cranks up way too hard, but it's not supposed to.
When she calls, keep her on the line as long as you can. Pretend you're on the fence, but tilting her way. Get her to do some coaxing.
She gets the sense I'm vamping, she'll know why, and she'll hang up. Hot and dumb usually go together, but not in her case.
You're a reporter, so you're a bullshit artist. Just use your gift.
What's that noise?
I'm whisking eggs for an omelet.
Not all roses, is it, being a widower?
It's better than the alternative. This bitch could put a man off women for life.
Get over your hissy fit before she calls. No matter how slick you think you are, she'll hear the edge in your voice.
Don't worry about me. When those ground units find her, they better slam her fast and good.
Just keep her on the line, Larkin said. And don't burn the toast.
The attorney terminated the call, and Hannafin said,
"Eat me, ambulance chaser,"
when he thought there was no one to hear. Chapter 20. Carrying the tote, wearing horn-rimmed glasses, auburn hair curling from under her baseball cap, Jane walked south, away from the vacant house and from the Hannafin place, into the shrouded and expectant morning. The storm continued to withhold its rain, but now it breathed away the stillness. The sharp edges of quivering palm fronds shaved whispers from one another. They would rattle noisily if the breeze became a wind. When she passed a drain gate, she dropped the disposable phone between its bars and hesitated only long enough to hear the cell plop in the fragrant dead rat darkness. She walked a block and a half and turned east at the corner. Her black Ford Escape was parked under the weeping, lacy branchlets of pepper trees. The car had been stolen in the U.S., significantly souped up in Nogales, Mexico, given a new engine number, repainted, and consigned to an unlicensed auto sales operation across the border in Nogales, Arizona. The car dealer operated out of a series of unmarked barns on a former horse ranch, and he didn't accept checks or credit cards. Or make loans. She paid with some serious cash she'd taken away from some bad people in New Mexico. The vehicle's GPS, with its identifying transponder, had been stripped out, so the Escape couldn't be tracked by satellite. For now, she was done with the San Gabriel Valley, although not with Lawrence Hannafin. He wouldn't get a significant part of her attention, not when she had much bigger fish to gut. But he was one of them, a member of the Confederacy of Sociopaths that D.J. Michael and the late Bertolt Schenck, weavers of the web, had woven, and she would make him pay sooner rather than later. She drove west into the San Fernando Valley, which showed more signs of wear and weariness than did the San Gabriel. The decline was not evident in every town, and often the deterioration had a threadbare, genteel character, but in places, it was stark, a smear of rot and desperation by which to diagnose the corruption that was hollowing out the country. In an area that had thus far escaped blight, she stopped at a deli and ordered takeout for lunch, relying not just on a new hairstyle and prop glasses to avoid being recognized, but also on an attitude that no one would associate with a fugitive. She didn't keep her head down, didn't pull the bill of her cap to her eyebrows, didn't avoid eye contact, but instead smiled brightly at everyone, chatted up the guy taking her order, and stooped to have an amusing conversation with a cute little girl who was waiting with her mother to pick up their order. Jane wasn't a Texan, but Nick had been born and raised there, and she'd been around his parents often enough to be able to imitate their drawl, which was nothing like her voice as people had heard it on the bits of FBI video being run on the news. As she sat in her car to eat, lightning blistered the sky three times in quick succession, trees and buildings and passing traffic seeming to shudder along the strobed street, followed by a crack like the mantle of the earth, split by the violent upthrow of some catastrophic force. Rain fell with tropical intensity. The world blurred beyond the Ford's windows, and Jane welcomed the privacy. Chapter 21. The gnomes stood, long-suffering in the rain. The single-story ranch-style house in Reseda was well-maintained. On the gate of the white picket fence, a green plaque declared, in fanciful white letters, Grandpa and Grandma's place. Six gnomes inhabited the yard, a group of three quite contemplative, and another three that were frozen in the postures of a dance. There was a birdbath as well and a four-foot-high windmill. A sign above the front door read, Bless this house. All that was bullshit, the owner's version of camouflage. If these people ever had grandchildren, they had probably eaten them. Property records identified the owners as John and Judy White, and though they lived here, they called themselves Pete and Lois Jones. Only God knew their real names, and possibly not even him. They were Syrian refugees who had probably never been Syrians, who'd been accepted into the U.S. with forged papers that they later destroyed. They were supposedly living in Boston with sponsoring relatives, but the relatives didn't exist, though Boston was real. Stepping onto the sheltered stoop, Jane closed her collapsible umbrella, leaned it against a flower pot, and rang the bell. Lois opened the door. A 50-something black-haired Zoftig woman in a too-small pink sweatsuit, green fingernail polish, six rings with diamonds the size of grapes, dark eyes, and a stare that could fillet a fish. She spoke around the cigarette that dangled from her lower lip. In what sounded more like an Eastern European accent than one shaped in the Middle East, the woman said,
It's early for you.
I have a lot to do later. I was hoping my order was ready.
You're wet.
It's raining. I'm sorry.
It's all right, darling. You come in.
The house reeked of cigarette smoke.
Sit, sit, Lois said. I talk to Pete.
On the blue sofa lay a fat white cat. It glared at Jane, its viperous eyes as yellow as egg yolks. Jane perched on the edge of a Lazy Boy lounger. Nothing about the interior of the house supported the Norman Rockwell exterior, but nothing about it was unusual either, until you went to the big room at the back, where Pete chain-smoked while he worked with antique presses and laser printers and laminating machines and all manner of other equipment to produce impeccable forged documents of numerous kinds. She had been referred to these people by the black market car dealer in Nogales, Enrique de Soto, who'd sold her the Ford Escape. She had known Enrique because she had crossed his path while still working as a bureau agent during the search for a serial killer named Marcus Paul Headsman, who felt obliged to live up to his name by collecting heads. Headsman stole one of Enrique's stolen cars, a moment of street justice in a society inclined to guarantee real justice less often every year. And, after his arrest, he hoped to gain a favor or two by giving up the Hot Wheels dealer. There are more criminals than good guys to chase them down. It is necessary for cops of all brands to practice triage, much the way that emergency room physicians do in a crisis with too many wounded to treat. As happened more often than the public would believe, those authorities to whom Enrique had been referred were harried and short-handed and chasing bigger game than him. His file was put in a drawer labeled something like When Hell Freezes Over, where it would turn yellow and brittle until a decade or two hence it would be thrown out to make room for new cases no one had the time to investigate. Jane had visited Lois and Pete 2 days previously. As part of their service, they provided 5 high-quality wigs in a variety of colors and hairstyles, an array of non-prescription contact lenses that changed her eye color, new counterfeit license plates, and photographs to be used on a new batch of driver's licenses. A second white cat appeared and hissed at Jane, back arched, eyes the shade of green suitable for the stew in a witch's cauldron. She got up from the lazy boy and the cat leaped into it, and Jane moved to a well-scratched leather armchair. Although she already had a collection of forged licenses, they were no longer of any value to her. They were in different names and were issued from different states, but each bore a photo of her as she had looked before her face had been broadcast nationwide. When Lois returned, she carried a small manila envelope and a plastic shopping bag that contained the 5 wigs, which would need to be worn in coordination with the phony licenses. Jane took the laminated IDs from the envelope and sorted through them. 6. Issued in different names. 1 featured a photo of her as she currently looked, and 5 involved wigs. Pete understood that photos taken by the junk cameras at every department of motor vehicles seldom closely resembled their subjects, and were never glamour shots. He recreated the harsh lighting of the DMV portraits, and she worked up expressions that weren't too absurd, but that made her look a bit geeky. Presented with these pictures, no one would think of the rogue FBI agent, and the vagueness of the shots allowed her to prettify or uglify herself, as the situation might require, and still resemble the woman on the license. Best of all, Pete worked with a black hat hacker of such refined criminal skill that he could backdoor any DMV computer system in the country and insert a crafted file that would appear legitimate to any policeman who might stop her for speeding or for any other reason. She had paid in advance, and as she returned the 6 licenses to the envelope, she said, "These were worth every penny, but your wig prices are outrageous." Lois blew a smoke ring. "Good business to sell support merchandise at juicy markup. We discount nobody nothing, darling." Jane would have taken pleasure in arresting them if she'd had the authority to do so, and if she hadn't needed their help to stay free and alive. She said, "It's a long way from Syria, huh?"
"Syria is toilet. Have nice day."
Chapter 22. By 6:30 Thursday evening, 5 hours after the attack, the snow began to taper off and the street lamps came on. In the glare of emergency work lights, the smoke rising from the half-collapsed and burnt-out Veblen Hotel, once black and dense, issued now white and thin, suggestive of ethereal presences, of spirits ascending from this place of fiery death. Snowflakes, grown larger here at storm's end, spiraled slowly down with the solemn grace of flower petals cast by mourners into an open grave. Sheriff Luther Tillman stood on the corner of Fitzgerald and Main, across the street from the devastation, hands in the pockets of his quilted Thermaloft insulated uniform jacket. From time to time, the rhythm and velocity of his dragon smoke exhalations changed visibly, evidence of his mood phasing from anger to sorrow and back again to anger. He was thankful that the buildings flanking the hotel had sustained less damage than might have been expected, but that was meager solace in light of the scale of destruction. The death toll currently stood at 42, including the governor and the district's congressman, but that number would surely climb as searchers raked the ruins. He stood there in frustration, having been nudged aside first by the state police, then more aggressively by FBI agents from their Minneapolis field office, and most recently by bureau specialists who flew in from Quantico, primarily from Behavioral Analysis Unit 1, which dealt with terrorism, arson, and bombings. He didn't resent them. They possessed the special knowledge and the resources to investigate this event more thoroughly than any county sheriff's department could have done, and that a congressman was among the victims meant it had become a federal crime. However, this was his jurisdiction, too, and too many of the dead were his friends and neighbors. He was heartsick, and his grief was sharpened by his feeling of uselessness. In spite of the cold and the foul fumes that came and went on the vagaries of the evening air, townspeople had gathered in the area to watch and to stand a vigil for the dead. Luther's deputies gently advised them to move back when they got too close, and gave patient counsel to those who worried about the fate of loved ones. But there was little else that anyone from his department could do in the face of the overwhelming presence of federal authorities. He was a figure of interest to the crowd because he stood 6 feet 3, remained still ramrod straight at 51, had been